I've just been reading this, The Last Temptation by David Miller. Have you read that one? No. Well, this is a fraction again. Well, this is important because it puts God in it. Puts it where he is. So it's important for that. And it's the only one that's it's the only one that's broke down a little bit of all these people.
Some of the things you've said have been so provocative that it's very difficult to know where to start, could you?
Well, this is where I'm starting, right at the beginning, 1940.
Right.
Now, this is where I started, you see, because once upon a time, when I was a school child, I began sort of cutting up some hailstones, and they were peculiar shapes, so my brother, 6 years older than me, wrote a letter to nature. Quite a nice, simple beginning. And the same issue that his letter was in was where the first big paper on nuclear energy was. So when I came up to Oxford in a general paper, when there was something about what is the most important development for the last 10 years discussed, I wrote an essay on nuclear energy.
1940.
Well, that was 1939, I actually wrote it. Now, the first thing that happened was my headmistress was approached, wanting me to go to Cambridge. And I had no desire to go to Cambridge. And she did everything. She even wrote to Somerville and said, I didn't want a scholarship, I wanted to go to Cambridge. So the principal of Somerville wrote to me and I said, I want to come to Oxford, I don't want Cambridge. Anyway, so as soon as I got here, it turned out my tutor was Dorothy Hodgkin, and she, of course, was a communist. So right away, Iris Murdoch was going around, at that stage, most communists were recruited at school. Did you know that?
No, I always thought it started at university.
No, they were nearly all recruited at schools. And all through the 20s and 30s, they aimed at catching them young, catching them at school. So all the people like Philby who went up and nearly and McLean, they'd nearly all been recruited when they were at school.
Really?
And anyway, Iris Murdoch invited some of us to tea. Well, she picked 11. 8 were already in the net as communists. 3 of us had been picked up on our general paper.
Simply from your ideas?
One had been picked up because she'd written sociological ideas in her general paper. Mm. But she finished up in the student Christian movement and is now a vicar's wife. The next one they picked up was the headmaster's daughter from a South Wales coal field. She was so bored she went to sleep. And the third one they picked up me on the nuclear. Because at that stage, Victor Rothschild was collecting together in Cambridge people who they hoped they'd be able to become communists and then infiltrate into nuclear energy. So that meant, of course, I was in Oxford, not Cambridge. Cambridge had all the biological nuclear side. Oxford had all the political side. And Harold Wilson was running the political section of a subversive group in Oxford. So Iris Murdoch took, well, the one who went in the SCM dropped out after her tea party. She took the other 10 of us to a meeting in Wilson's room where there were about 40 or 50 people, and Wilson was talking to them as if they were all the faithful. Well, Lester went to sleep on the floor. I listened and was interested, and I noticed there's another man who listened and was interested, and everybody else looked as if they were laughing it up. Now, what Wilson said then was that the subversive group organisation in this country was in 4 sections, a communist and left wing that everybody thinks is it, and a political and a biological and an economic group. And Wilson had already been chosen as head of the political group and already been told that in due course he'd be put in as prime minister. And he said the overall head was the head of the biology group. Well, the political and economic is obvious. Biology at that stage wasn't obvious. So when from Harwell we knew that the MRC unit were ordered by the MRC to accept communists as advisors, and then they began faking evidence, that looked like a way into finding more about the biological side. So that's where I began.
So what year was that then, Kitty, that you actually got onto the biological side?
I moved from Harvard to Oxford in 1956, and by then it was obvious something was very, very wrong.
But obvious to whom? To you?
To me, to the security officer there, to a few of us who were interested. We began smelling a big rat, actually, about 2 or 3 years before, because at that stage, calcification of bone, you know, bone cancer with isotopes, sort of the bone physiology and calcification, and there was a man, Newman, in America, who had published a lot of good work. Then all of a sudden he published a paper that was total rubbish. And, you know, we began wondering why. At that time, I wasn't in the Medical Research Council group, I was in the general physics with the X-ray and the electron microscope. But we had a small section working on, or shall I say, semi-biological things by that time. Then when Newman came over for a discussion with the MRC, they completely lost track of him for 24 hours. And he came along, this is in the middle of summer, and he said, oh, it had been so hot in New York he was exhausted. He'd gone to a hotel to sleep it off. He couldn't remember the name of the hotel, he couldn't remember where it was, just somewhere in London. And for all 24 hours he vanished off the scene before he surfaced at Harwell again. So that got security very interested. Then when they knew that Dr. Thewlis and I were interested in the faking of research, then we gradually began to add two and two together.
And what did you make two and two come to?
Well, I decided that a good sort of kicking off place was the orthopedic department. So I went in with Professor Trueta, and we fixed for me to move from Harwell to his department as a non-clinical lecturer doing research. And I spent about half of my time doing genuine research, half, you know, harmless research, arthritis and that sort of thing. And the other half, Trueta had been getting very worried because his work on osteoporosis had been blocked. So I went firmly into following up what he'd been doing. And the sort of general scheme at that stage, wherever I realised that work was being blocked, or fake results published, and I sort of moved into those fields.
Where have you felt that the impetus for the faking was coming from all the time, and what was the object?
The impetus came from the Medical Research Council.
And what was their motive then?
Well, now then, if you take what in fact things that have been faked, the anti-smoking campaign, when they discovered that it was diesel smoke that was causing the increase in lung cancer, that was the time when the Macmillan government were wanting to take industrial goods off the railways onto the roads. Mm. Because if all the industrial transport is on the roads, they're at the mercy of the oil companies. Quite simple. But he'd no reason for taking industrial goods off railways onto the roads. And if people had known that diesel smoke was responsible for the rise in lung cancer, then they wouldn't. So Richard Doll and somebody else, I've forgotten his name now, came out with a paper saying that smoking had caused lung cancer. Well, the paper was... the only way to call it is a very crudely faked statistics to get that answer.
But there have been
and dozens of people, for instance, including the then president of the Royal Society, were quite unable to get their criticisms of that paper published. Half the Oxford, most of the Oxford chemistry school knew what was wrong. But that went on being published, and the criticisms didn't see the light of day at all.
But there have been similar researches in the States, haven't there, which have come up with the same supposed results.
Yes, but what you can find, where is it there? If you have the energy to go to the library and spend a week or two there, if you take any topic you like, and the date, the time, or the date it really is, first of all, somebody has an idea or makes an observation. Then more and more people climb on the bandwagon, and the number, and that is the number of papers. And then you've really got nearly all the answers, and you begin dotting the I's and crossing the T's, and the number of papers goes down like that. And that's what happens with any topic that's not being interfered with. Now, if you take the diesel smoke and lung cancer, it began going like that. And in fact, it got to the stage when it had been proven, and suddenly only three more papers. Now, the smoking and lung cancer, the number of papers after that first one went up like that and has stayed high ever since. A propaganda campaign pushing it and pushing it and
public
pushing it.
Public awareness, I suppose, follows the line of,
yes,
of the growth of the papers, does it?
And yes, it's
but are you saying that unless it follows that Gaussian distribution, something is not?
Anything where it's worth looking at hard. If it doesn't follow that distribution of papers. The smoking is an extreme example, where you had your diesel quite happily here, and then your cigarette here. And they go
on
and on
such a worldwide, or say worldwide, a magic-wide conspiracy to...
Well, to get as much as you can off the railways onto the roads, and then the oil companies can control industrial transport.
So it's an oil company mafia really doing it, isn't it?
From that point of view, but it's been used for all sorts of other things. The Health Education Council was set up to propagate that. But then later on, when the pill began causing thrombi and coronaries in women, you suddenly found cigarettes were meant to be causing heart disease. And cigarettes became a catch-all after that. So then if you want to fake any other statistics, you make allowances for cigarette smoking. And if you make allowances, you can fiddle your figures where you want. So the smoking has allowed them to fake a whole lot of other statistics.
So it's mostly to be the scapegoat.
Yeah.
How come the tobacco barons allow that to happen? Don't they have as much sway as the oil faction?
Oil executives have got onto nearly all their boards. Well, it's quite interesting. I've forgotten which company. I think it was Anglo-American. Their chairman resigned. The day after he resigned, he made a public statement saying smoking had nothing to do with lung cancer. It was in one issue of the Standard. The next issue of the Standard edition, it wasn't in. And the company put out a statement saying he hadn't been authorised to say that, period. A man from Rothman came to see me. Went back all full of enthusiasm, got sat on.
Really?
Even within the tobacco company, then?
They're controlled by the board, and there's oil people on all their boards. So they kept under control that way. And you notice most of the tobacco people are diversifying now.
Have you aggressively, if that's the right word in this context, but have you aggressively tried to make that point to other people, the fact that you feel that tobacco is not, or don't you really feel that it's...
I sent a paper to the Lancet. It went round all their staff, but of course, you know, we're not allowed to publish it. I've sent it to the Department of Health, and they've conveniently filed it and forgotten about it.
What about National Press?
National Press are not allowed to publish.
Not allowed to?
They'd lose a lot of their advertising. So that was one that came out as a sideline. Now the pill, as I say, Professor Trader had been stopped off with his osteoporosis. Then I realised that they were stopping him off because he was getting too near the fact that hormones were involved. So I began following the hormone. And in fact, I'd been working from 58 until 62, I'd been working on what turned out to be the mechanism whereby the pill caused thrombi, and I'd never heard of the pill. I didn't hear of it till 62. I've been working on it for 4 years. So when I heard of it next year, I put some of the pill compounds into my rabbits and got them absolutely full of thrombi.
So those dangers are real, and the public has now been made aware of it.
More than the pill, of course. I've not been the only person on that one. And Ellen Grant, at the end of April, will have a book published called Bitter Pill. And the side effects of the pill are horrific. And they include problems with the immune system and allergies. They also include, if teenagers take the pill, in fact anybody, there are a lot of mental effects and depression, but all this epidemic of teenage suicide is nearly all the pill.
So you're talking about, you're introducing another idea too, that it affects the immune system. So
yes.
Are you now suggesting that there may be a link between AIDS and the pill?
People
been attacking mostly men because of...
People who are children of women who've been on the pill are more likely to be susceptible than other people, let's put it that way. It'll increase the susceptibility.
The thing that started Kitty off, well, that's not true, but the thing I happen to say to Kitty, you know that for many years it's always been my theory that the British defence policy is based on things you can see and measure, which are nice, convenient things.
Missiles.
That's right, you can see them, therefore you can protect
them.
Yes. I happen to say to Kitty that I believe that the real problem, if you really wanted to win, was biological warfare.
Oh, yes,
and immediately she came back and hit me between the eyes with this thing, oh well, of course AIDS is a spin-off from biological warfare, or bacteriological warfare, and that. Can you explain how you got into that field and how you learned enough to know to make that sort of...
No. This is the first draft of a letter I'm trying to write on this. Well, what I thought was, there was a very nice thing in the Daily Mail. Their women's editor has interviewed the man in the department working on trying to get an antidote to AIDS without saying who he was. So I thought I'd write to her, and sort of say to her, you know, will you please pass this on to him, at the same time she can read it. No, it's somewhere under here. I may find the draft of what I'm trying to write. Yeah, that's it. Well, if I'll tell you, shall I read this to you? Let me read this. This isn't the final draft, but it's got the facts in. You see, what I put in this is, I read your article in the Daily Mail with interest, that's the 9th of February. You did not say which hospital you had visited, and so I would be grateful if you would send this letter to the consultant who you quoted. He is wasting his time studying the geography and anthropology of Central Africa. The AIDS virus did indeed spread from there, but it had been artificially planted there. I first heard of an intelligence report about 6 years or so ago, saying that a new mutated virus had been let loose there that was an untreatable form of venereal disease. The scientists responsible for it were probably Soviet scientists, though the possibility of them being British scientists cannot be overlooked. It would seem that members of the Agricultural Research Council spread rinderpest in West Africa at about the same time. And that was after Rothschild had been appointed head of the Agricultural Research Council, and he started them working on this. Now, the methods of mutating viruses originated in this country in the 1950s. Then, under the auspices of UNESCO, the UK entered into a series of agreements with the USSR dealing with topics in the scientific, technological, educational, and cultural fields. Once in 1959, Command 917, 1961, Command 1375, 1963, Command 2059, and I think 1965, and I still haven't checked that, and that's Command 2652, made provision for giving Soviet scientists instruction in techniques for the mutation of viruses. By 1963, and that's Command 2059 again, it was further agreed that the UK and the USSR should conduct joint research programs on problems of virology, antibiotics, psychopharmacology, etc. And with the psychopharmacology, the UK has provided the USSR with most of the techniques they use in their psychiatric prisons. There have been three places in this country. I don't know, I think one in the Midlands and one somewhere in the, possibly the Isle of Wight. But Craig House Mental Hospital in Edinburgh, they've done a lot of experiments on patients.
It's not the same Craig House where all World War One poets were at one stage, Sassoon and Owen. Craig Lockhart it was called then. Would it be the same
place? I don't know. Because one time when I went up to Edinburgh, I got on to one of the Catholic priests and asked questions. All the other mental hospitals in Edinburgh, the Archbishop appoints the chaplains. Craig House, the medical director, appoints the chaplains. And I discovered that the Catholic chaplain who had been appointed was an infiltrator into the church anyhow.
By whom was he infiltrated then, you think?
Well, this is another big sidetrack. 1935 to 1938, members of the Communist Party were told to leave the Communist Party or not to join it. So they didn't become party members, so they could always say, I'm not a communist. You see, Healy left the party. I don't think Wilson and Heath ever actually joined it. Now, 1948, the rank and file were given those instructions. They had to leave a hardcore in the Communist Party to pretend to be the communists, but all the others were told to leave, to infiltrate the political parties, to infiltrate the churches, and so on. So in the early 1950s, a great many communists were quite deliberately infiltrated. It started, you see, in the 1930s, and the numbers escalated in the 1950s. They were infiltrating the churches for the purpose of subverting them, as well as infiltrating the political parties.
Continue with your fascination.
At that time, the 48 one, I was living in a workers' hostel in Coventry that the Midlands Strike Organisation used as their headquarters. And every Wednesday night they had a meeting sort of discussing how they were to organise strikes and so on. This particular Wednesday night, this order was read out to them. Now, up till then, they'd all sat at about three tables, you know, in the canteen. Next morning at breakfast, they were all scattered around in ones and twos among everybody else. And I tried it about three or four weeks later. I sort of said to one or two people, now which are the communists? And they'd forgotten already. Anyway, now where'd I got to? Oh, next there was an agricultural agreement, Command 2648 1965, subsequently updated, Command 6044 1974, in which the United Kingdom undertook to give the USSR live strains of all foot and mouth viruses, swine vesicular disease virus, and live samples of many other agricultural pests. This was followed by the 1967 outbreak of foot and mouth disease, leading to unpleasantness with the Argentine that culminated in the Falklands War, and bovine TB, both having characteristics compatible with having been introduced by an aerosol spray, even though badgers were falsely accused of the latter. There was also an outbreak of swine vesicular disease.
Now, what about anthrax? Were there any?
I haven't seen any. The foot and mouth, they had about 8 or 9 outbreaks on one day, starting it, and they were in a straight line across Lancashire and the Lake District. No, it didn't follow roads or anything, so the conclusion that the local farmers came to was somebody from Blackpool Airport had flown across spraying. And I heard that from the farmers up there. I've never seen or heard it from anybody else. But one of them showed me the map he'd drawn. And they were, it could almost, on a straight line, these initial outbreaks that it all came from. Now, the Ministry of Agriculture put out a report about the bovine TB, blaming the badgers. But it was the sort that all came in the glands round the head first. And that is absolutely typical of an aerosol effort.
So you see, very technical and very,
yes,
and very logically thought out by Kitty.
But you see, the bovine one I got entirely from their own paper, without looking at it independent.
Do you see some central Machiavellian organisation?
Yes.
Which tries all these various insidious methods.
Well, you come back to the same 2 or 3 men in whatever you're doing. You come back to the same
thing. Let's hear the
In 1975, Harold Wilson signed a far-ranging agreement with the USSR, Command 5924, that included an agreement on cooperation in the field of medicine and public health to remain in force for an indefinite period. This agreement included the blanket covering statement: the party shall develop and widen cooperation on important problems of medicine and public health on the basis of reciprocity and taking into account mutual interests. The various forms of this cooperation shall be determined by mutual consent. There have been subsequent meetings and more detailed agreements that the DHSS has refused to divulge. And a joint committee for cooperation in the field of medicine and public health was set up. Names of the British members of the committee do not seem to have been divulged, nor yet its intentions. In his 1975 agreement, Wilson specifically mentioned problems associated with the surveillance and control of influenza and other communicable diseases. Experiments with viruses had shown that they could be mutated, with the formation of more virulent strains, and it is this type of mutant that can most easily be recognized as being in fact a mutation. Similarly, the use of antibiotics, also mentioned in Wilson's agreement, has led to more virulent strains of bacteria, the resistant hospital staphylococci being the best known examples of these. And it is these two lines of research that have been a constant feature in our medical agreements with the USSR. In the USSR, as well as work in academic centres, related work on the production of different types of mutation are also thought to be in progress in at least 6 plants. Do you want me to spell them?
Why not?
AKSU ZAGORSK POKROY ONUTMINSK SVERDLOVSK and BERSK that are described as being centres for agricultural research and development. In this country, the Ministry of Defence used to have the microbiological research establishment at Porton, where work was carried out on trying to develop antidotes and methods of treatment for bacterial and other infections that might be used in biological warfare. In the 1970s, a group in the DHSS that was in close touch with the USSR pulled strings that in due course resulted in MRE being handed over to the DHSS for reasons that were never made clear. It is since that time that this country, and indeed the rest of the world, have suffered a whole series of epidemics from new virus diseases. Many have shown characteristics that have made it clear that they must have been artificially spread. The USA has also been involved in a similar exercise, but I have fewer details of their involvement. So far as I know, with the exception of AIDS, these epidemics have not been of lethal viruses, but other lethal mutations are believed to have been prepared. With the loss of MRE Porton, we no longer have a group working to devise protective measures. There are reports that scientists in the USSR are refining and making more lethal diseases such as the plague, anthrax, tuberculosis and diphtheria. More important are thought to be Lassa fever, that's 35% lethal, Ebola fever, 70% lethal, and green monkey disease, virtually 100% lethal. While working on increasing their lethality, Soviet scientists are also cutting their incubation time so that they will kill more quickly, while simultaneously developing prophylactic measures to protect Soviet troops and civilians from their effects.
Legionnaire's disease.
Huh?
Legionnaire.
It could well be another one.
That's another one.
I've no evidence whatever on that, but it could well be another one.
Well, what is AIDS, then, Kitty?
What AIDS does, it cuts out the immune system. So that they will pick up any illness, and something that we shrug off as a mild cold is likely to turn into pneumonia. And most of the people who've died of AIDS have died either of pneumonia or a sarcoma, because now this is another thing. I'm not quite sure, but with the pill, there are several sorts of cancer that are pushed on or caused by the pill. Because whatever the cancer is, you get it by an overproliferation of cells. So you see, there's an epidemic of breast cancer because the pill is overstimulating some of the breast tissues. There's an epidemic of cervical cancer because the pill is overstimulating those cells. And this sarcoma in men seems to be the same sort of overstimulation. But now that might be, and this is what we don't know how to find out at the minute, because the passive partner with the homosexuals is taking pill type of steroids to make themselves more effeminate. So it's the ones who die of cancer may well be the passive partners. And the active partners would probably be the ones more likely to die of the pneumonia.
But are you actually engaged in research on that as a topic, or is it something which you simply have this own personal dedication to?
What I've personally done with the pill is the thrombi effects, a bit of the mechanism of the cancer, and how it fitted in with some of the work that other people have been doing. But about 10 years ago, I've actually dropped all my work on the pill because other people were working, you see, and Alan Grant will be publishing a book on that. And I've concentrated much more on the radiation.
Now, you suggested to me that the radiation connection with biology, it was what led you to your conclusions about AIDS. I still don't understand what AIDS is. What actually causes it?
It's a virus.
But how do you create this? It's a mutant of some sort.
It's a mutant of one of ordinary venereal diseases.
And it was tested in South Africa?
Central Africa.
Central Africa.
Now, I think the idea was to wipe out a lot of Africans. This homosexual one, I think, has taken them by surprise.
How did they think they were going to spread it then? Simply by introducing it into the water or...
How they spread it, I don't know. A lot of things have been spread by aerosols of various sorts. That's a favourite method of spreading a virus. How they did it in Africa, I don't actually know.
So, the fact that suddenly the homosexual society was being swept by it was a total...
Well, I don't think it was really intended to go beyond Africa. Mm. But this homosexual effect, and I think the fact that the passive partners are taking the steroids is what has helped enormously.
Are the steroids in the pill then?
Yeah. Yes, the pill is a mixture of two steroids.
Totally yes.
And so these passive partners are taking one of the steroids that's often put in the pill to make them more effeminate. Mm. And that's why I think they're the ones who are getting the cancer, because there's a far higher proportion of cancer among homosexuals for the sarcoma than among the normal male population. Mm.
Now, there must be other people besides yourself who know, who have made this connection. And yet you're willing to talk about it. Are other people willing to talk? Has anyone talked about it? The connection between AIDS and biological warfare.
I'm the only one willing to talk at the moment. Ellen, as I say, with her book on the pill, she can do it because her husband is absolutely unassailably one of the top surgeons in the country. But a lot of people, you see, who've worked on the pill have lost their jobs. Mm. They've had research grants removed. Ellen, it doesn't matter that she's lost her job. Well, with me, the way they did it was they pinched my superannuation and the DHSS.
What?
They put my superannuation into a different... I'm not quite sure what you'd call it. They took it out of the FSSU, put it into a permanent civil servant one, and since I'm not a permanent civil servant, sorry, they couldn't let me have it back again.
But what have you done that caused them to do that?
Well, I've been the one that's talked more than anybody. I've written and I've talked.
Well, I was going to say, I'm rather ignorant about what you may well have written. Have you written anything about the AIDS thing?
No, I haven't. The two things that I... Let's see. This is one of the things I've written, which is quite different. This is the biological side. The biological one is the next one. I'll have to sort of write up. Very early on was when I moved from Harwell to the Wingfield in Oxford and began working on these topics. Mm. Then Janet Ward and one or two of us realised straight away that I'd got into the centre of it. You can have that.
Thank you.
That was written in 78 originally, and that one was written last year. And the other thing, of course, is that
I look forward to reading those.
But I've talked about Harold Wilson being the head of the political
group
for a long time.
Yes, I can imagine that caused a few problems.
So, I mean, altogether I've talked.
Why do you think he disappeared from the limelight?
Oh, quite simple.
It's more than his health, surely.
Oh, very, very simple. Because... Now, this is where the smear on Roger Hollis came in, you see. By about 1962-3, round about then, after his visit to America, after his visit to America in 63, that would be it, They'd just about had enough evidence to prosecute him. And Roger Hollis and somebody else in MI5 were working on it, and Sir Theobald Matthews, DPP. And that leaked out somehow, that they'd nearly got enough evidence to prosecute him. Sir Theobald died of a heart attack all of a sudden, and Peter Wright started up the smear campaign against Roger. So that sort of fell through, and Wilson became Prime Minister and went from strength to strength. Then in 68, after Wedgwood Benn's agreement with the Soviet Union and doing away with the civil defense, and if you remember, that was the year too when the Ministry of Health was changed to the DHSS, and he began making active preparations for us to go into the European Union. So MI5 had a team working on that once again, and that got a big fillip, of course, with his 1975 agreement, and once again they were nearly ready to prosecute him, only somebody who didn't realise Chapman Pincher was around and went and talked too much to Chapman Pincher. And so Wilson resigned, and Callaghan sacked the team who'd been working on him on the grounds that they were right-wing extremists. That's when he suddenly resigned from being Prime Minister.
Have you been yourself actively involved in security then?
Not in security, but on the atomic energy side, I know a lot of them. And sort of on the fringes, if you like. I've got to know a lot that's going on. And over Rothschild in MI5, before Henry Arnold died, he told me an enormous amount about Rothschild, because they suspected him as early as 1939. But he had too big a political pull, and Guy Liddell helped to protect him, so they couldn't get rid of him. All they could do was stop him getting some of the most secret papers.
So really, in a sense, are you running a one-person campaign on these things, or is it something that you do occasionally, or is it a way of life for you now to...
Well, for a sound, born curious, and I like to know the answers. And when I get anything that's way outside, like the pill, somebody like Alan Grant will take it up. So I've got different people taking up different aspects of it. So what I would say, if you want to write a book around Victor Rothschild as head of the biology
group. Well, frankly, because of the military side and because of the biological, I've always been convinced that biological and bacteriological warfare is the thing. That if you really want to go to war, that's the way to go. It's very simple. And what appealed to me, although all our conversation appealed to me, what really focused my attention was when you said AIDS, and the minute you said it, it seemed to me that that is exactly the way you go about it. And now that it is self-multiplying, you wait until you get to the exponential point on the curve where it will continue to go by itself. And at that point, you immunize your population and you've won the war. And that's what fascinated us about it.
Well, you see, the pill is the next generation. It's weakening them enormously.
But do you think the pill was really invented and promulgated with good intentions?
No, with bad intentions.
So from the very beginning?
Right from the very beginning, they were prepared to murder to stop people discovering the side effects. There was a time in America where the biggest single cause of death of bone pathologists was murder. Because it was the bone pathologists and its effect working through the bone marrow that is one of the most dangerous of the side effects.
Is it commercial reasons then?
Well, I personally think biological warfare reasons.
Even with a pill?
Even with a pill.
That this is something that's so insidious that one wouldn't suspect it, one would just think that it's something benign that's turned out wrong.
You see, if you look even in this country now, the white population here are getting pill-pushing propaganda. Now, there's a form of the pill that is even more dangerous than the present pill, called Depo-Provera.
Oh, I've read about it, yes.
Now that Ellen is... Now that Ellen's book is published, a lot of women are going to be off the pill. So the Department of Health is going to say, Depo-Provera is safe, we have authorised it, you better use that instead. And it's about 10 times more dangerous. So last year, before they decided that they would give it their blessing, they had a conference on it and took evidence. They took evidence from the family planning associations, they took evidence from medical people from the drug company, they refused to take evidence from independent people like Ellen and myself, or a couple of other doctors put up by the Patients Association. Now, Depo-Provera, I think, you know, I told you that there's a mental side effect of the pill. Well, this can go to the depression that leads to this epidemic of suicide. It brings up schizophrenia, and quite a lot of schizophrenia now is pill-induced. Now, this is another one that we haven't got to the bottom of. But I tried to put a scare into the Department of Health, asked my MP to ask a question about it, and all I got was a blind answer, they knew nothing about it. But 78, there was a conference in San Francisco, and the subject matter of the conference was that some of the ones with the schizophrenia from the pill, and whether it was... Yes, anyway, if you get the schizophrenia going to catatonic, and you get a really catatonic, it's lethal catatonic. And according to somebody who was at that conference, there have already around, in America and Puerto Rico and around there, been several hundred catatonic deaths. I've also heard rumours that there have been a number of catatonic deaths in this country.
What's the longest time now that any group of women would have been on the pill?
In the 1950s.
So we may have some women
who's
from that stage until they stop menstruating would have been on the pill for what, 20 odd years?
Well, most have to stop after 4 or 5 years because of side effects. But this 78 conference, well, somebody has stolen the evidence, but one doctor was collecting together the evidence, and quite a number of people who'd been at that conference were talking or likely to talk, and they've all nearly either died in car accidents or been murdered or something. Anybody at that conference who was showing any signs of talking. Now, one of the patients was in Birmingham. And you remember the woman who is alleged to have died, a technician alleged to have died of smallpox in Birmingham?
Oh, yes.
Well, she had the idea with the smallpox vaccine that you could maybe get a vaccine against this catatonic condition. And she tried it on herself and killed herself with a catatonic. Now, the only person who knew what she'd done was the head of her department. And he, in fact, did ring up somebody and tell them about her and what she died of and how. But he was murdered the next day. Theoretically, the inquest said he'd committed suicide. In fact, he'd been murdered. And there was no question of smallpox at all. She tried the experiment on herself of trying to get a vaccine. And she'd taken serum from this person in the catatonic condition.
So, is it your theory, Kitty, that we have in our, in positions of authority in our DHSS, people who deliberately encourage these
noxious... Yes.
And that they are communists? Motivated?
Or one world motivated, or plain greedy motivated.
It would have to be a fairly sophisticated organisation to be able to infiltrate concepts and products on a worldwide basis as most of them are.
Well, it is.
And do you think that recruitment into these sort of organisations is still at school level, as it was in the 30s?
Yes, and forged culture. Now what they do is, what's called the optics technique. Now, your intention is to have a world government. So on the way there, you have various objectives that you must reach. And then you get various subsidiary objectives that from all land up to the bad, you see. So the person planning knows that if you can achieve those, and then those, you'll then get your world government. So he then gets a lot of people with various actions. Now, a particular action may go help to contribute to that, and another action may be contributing to that, and again to that. So you get a lot of actions that contribute to different objectives, and some of them to quite harmless objectives, and you persuade your people that they're working for that when it incidentally does that. That means you can employ thousands of people who've no idea what they're working towards. That's known as the octopus technique.
So does this work on a self-perpetuating committee basis, or is the one operating?
There is one centre operating, the Rothschild family. And over the last two centuries, there's a lot of evidence been collected against them, but nobody dare use it. Nobody dare. I mean, you know, when Andrew Boyle, he wrote the book about blood, he had evidence on Rothschild, he daren't use it. Philip Knightley spent 8 years collecting evidence, and one day he may write his book, we don't know. People just daren't mention the man's name. But the Rothschild family are at the centre of all of it. And some of the people, they, as I say, they bribe. Others, they get convinced that the one world idea is a good idea. But you only need to have 300 or 400 people who actually know about that side of it. And other people may just have that as their objective and not know that it'll carry on further.
Do you think that there is any racial or religious motivation in it?
Satanic, yes. I've said this in the once in there. Quite a few people have been quite shocked at me pointing out how many of them are Satanists.
Mm. But presumably that could only be a means to an end rather than the ultimate objective.
Have you read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion?
Bits and pieces, yes, bits and pieces.
Now the Protocols, there was a conference in 1864, a Freemason conference in Paris. Bits of its proceedings were in fact published in Paris also in 1864, and I haven't got a copy of that. But the Imperial Russian Intelligence got the complete draft of the proceedings, and they realized in fact that what, and the Protocols, when you read them, all of them, they are describing accurately what's happening now as a plan. They describe the plan and it is being carried out. I mean, things like, you know, all these industrial states in towns. That's part of the plan as described in the Protocols in 1864.
I didn't realise that. I'd certainly looked at some of them because we had some friends who were very interested in what you might call cults.
Right.
A cult belief, where a belief was something which became the governing factor in all of one's actions.
Yeah.
And this was at the same time as we got the Gospel according to Levi, that period. I don't know whether you know that particular volume, but that again talks about Christ as being not Jesus Christ necessarily, as in Christian Christ, but maybe a particular individual who comes at intervals, I think, of 1,250 years, I forget exactly now, but
oh, I haven't heard that.
Yes, it's all to do with the stars, and again, the system of a Christ arriving. It so happens now that Jesus Christ, I think it's got another 150 years or something to go, and then the next Christ will arrive, which will be a completely different religion. Well, that's about a period, this was about 10, 12 years.
Oh. Now, anyway, this was, you see, from 1864, then the Russian attempted revolution 1903, the Russian intelligence put extracts in the newspapers. In 1905, they got Professor Nelis to publish the whole of it as an appendix to a book he was writing. Now, it was Nelis that gave it the title, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. But in fact, it's a banker's charter. I mean, the Zionists are used by the bankers, but it, when you read it carefully, it was obviously written by a banker. The economics in it are excellent.
This then relates very, I mean, didn't Adolf Hitler use some of them? Does it tie up with Hitler and Nationalism and National Socialism? The fact that that's why they weren't eager to support the Rothschild family, weren't averse to the rise of National Socialism?
Well, what you see Hitler did for, that helped them so much, part of what they want to do is to gain control of the world and keep control of the world. And people like the English are awfully awkward over that. So we have to be got rid of. In fact, the white race as a whole has to be got rid of. Well, you have the pill, you see, as one thing. Lots of white women take the pill. The Indians along the street there are told the pill is dreadful, you must have a child every year. So just a few families along the street in the town I've been here in the last 8, 9 or 10 years. When I first came, there were a lot of white children, a few Indian children. Now the same number of houses occupied by Indian. The swarms of Indian children and very few white children. But they also want intermixing. Because if you mix some races, the product can be better than the originals. If you mix other races, they're genetically incompatible and the product is worse than the original. For instance, if you take your pure Negro, he has high growth hormone all through his life, and growth hormone goes with a good memory. If you take your white child, high growth hormone until adolescence, the growth hormone goes down, one of the androgenic hormones comes in. And that goes with organization and coordination of ideas and creation. So you have your pure African with a good memory, can't invent anything, hopeless organizer, but he's got his good memory. Now you mix the two, and if you look at your American Negroes, your male has lost his memory, he hasn't brought in the coordination of ideas. So you're an American Negro man, you should just nowhere up to the white in ability, either with memory or with coordination of ideas.
So, I mean, how do you, get the best from each when you're genetically engineering?
So if you're genetically engineering, what they're aiming at is the worst. In the United Nations, from when it was formed for about 10 or 15 years, was paying teams of doctors to go around the world examining hormones, checking up what happened when you mixed different races, finding which were the races that didn't mix. And since then, it's been the United Nations policy to put large numbers of people of one race to another, mixing the incompatible. You see, Indian and African and white don't mix. So we've got all the West Indians coming in, all the Indians coming in here. Same thing in Canada. Then they'll be mixing in now a lot from the Far East. And these teams of doctors worked out which were incompatible. And that is what they're deliberately mixing. That's what our whole immigration policy is about.
So you're working really towards a slave almost community that's malleable and that's...
Now the way that Bertrand Russell put it was that they were engineering to have the clerks and the masters. And by the time they'd finished, the way, I don't know, I always remember this, he said that he wrote the way they did, this is published by the about 1954, he said that an insurrection of the plebs against the master would be as unthinkable as an insurrection of sheep against the practice of eating mutton.
Nicely put, isn't it?
Very. And that is what they're deliberately working for with all the immigration and racial policies.
Can I take you back to a specific again? I'm sorry to go back to the same thing, but if one's going to tell a story which relates to the Rothschilds, maybe the thing to do is to take something quite specific which is topical enough, which brings me back to the AIDS thing, which is very topical. What actually would be, in your view, the way in which this might have been deliberately tried out? Would there have been a committee that would have said, let's try it out? And could you speculate as to how it might have actually taken place, the decision to go and try it in Africa, and then what actually happened?
I'd imagine it's an autocratic decision. And who precisely made it, presumably Soviet or an East German, would be the one who would decide what, because there's a lot of this, and I wonder if I can find, I'll just see if I can find a piece of paper.
It seems to me that there are two factors here that you're talking about as being responsible for a lot of the evils of our time. And one of them is communism, and one of them is one of the most powerful and wealthy Jewish families. How do you... do you see any relationship between these
oh, families? Yes. Yes, communism was set up by the bankers.
Incompatible.
The communism, anything
else. So it's a great double bluff, was it then?
Well, the thing was, as far as I can tell, the Rothschild's enormous ambition started with Meyer Rothschild in about 1770. Now, he had five sons. He put Nathan in England, James in Paris, another one in Austria, another one in Frankfurt, another one in Italy. And the two houses that have gone from strength to strength have been the English and the French. But they thought at that stage, by international banking, purely financial, they could get control of the world. And they worked up to the 1848 a series of rebellions right across Europe. But then the Tsar would have nothing whatever to do with borrowing from the banks. In fact, interfered and put back the German princes on their thrones and so on. So the only country where the ruler was, in fact, permanently off the throne was France. And then they decide, and at the same time that was happening, they were just recovering from having missed the revolutions, when a People's Bank was set up in France and Austria. And the People's Bank just missed toppling the Rothschilds Bank. So then they realized that they must have a sort of approach from the other end as well, and they began helping Marx and Engels. And the whole thing was born around about 1858. And then the 2 years later, they formed the International, what is it, Working Men's Association. So in fact, it is the Rothschilds who set up communism. And all the way through now, as the Soviets go on taking over one country after another, the multinationals get the minerals. You see, the multinationals control nearly all the mineral and fuel in the Soviet Union. The multinationals help them. You see, if you take Rhodesia, Lancaster House conference, the 1978 conference in Osaka, where Solodovnikov, who was a KGB head, was working out the tactics of taking over the country. Nkomo was to have been the dictator. But when it came to the point, Nkomo was Africa for the Africans. He refused to hand over Rhodesian minerals to the multinationals. So two-thirds of the way through the Lancaster House conference, Solodovnikov sent Coanda to tell Carrington that he must have Mugabe instead of Nkomo. They then had a week's with no meetings. Mugabe was sent for to meet Solodovnikov in Addis Ababa and get his orders. And then Soames told Mugabe that whatever the level of intimidation, he wouldn't cancel the election results. But he didn't announce them until after Mugabe signed the agreement with the multinationals that they could have the minerals. And this has been going on all the way through. But the two are working together, absolutely hand in hand.
And you don't think the Rothschilds ever think that communism in itself might become such a force that they could no longer control it?
No, they couldn't.
The financial grasp is such that...
The financial grasp is such that the communism as such wouldn't have a chance. Now, Rebecca, there's something else we're looking at on it. I stretch my leg out a long, long way out of these. And my final submission of the inquiry, I put a whole lot of this in. And poor Sir Frank Layfield didn't know what to make of it. Now, the reaction was that Frank and the lawyers were absolutely astounded that I was prepared to name names. I just isn't done. And I think they all thought I'd get about a dozen libel actions by return post. And of course, I haven't done it.
Shouldn't you have had a car accident by now?
Well, my car, there's been something wrong. It's in the garage at the moment. I've had to have the police with it twice.
Really?
Since then. And it's in the garage, we're putting it right at the moment. So, let's see about this.
So, is it touching?
That's another thing worth reading.
You did suggest that that the AIDS virus, the mutant, was introduced into Africa, and I think you suggested the mid-70s and possibly Southern Rhodesia.
No, Central Africa.
Central Africa.
Yeah. No, more on the West Coast. Do I mean... Yes, the West Coast.
West Coast. Mm. I think you said that it would have developed from some... on the back of some bovine experiments or associated with cattle or agricultural would have been the title for the organization that might have promulgated that.
A lot of different... It started out as agricultural, then went on to... But there hasn't been an organization. You can never pin any of this down to an organization.
It's supposition.
It's a loose... It's a loose network, which isn't an organization. But one man will be on one committee, and he may be on another committee, and he'll put somebody else on another committee, or in another organization. But what he avoids like the plague is having... Because once you have an organization, it can be infiltrated.
But how would you physically... Let's suppose you took the flu virus, for example. You would have to get it. You then have to... Somebody would have to say, let's take it to... West Africa or East Africa?
Well, take a flu.
How would you do that?
Well, take the flu virus. One which was spread in America that I do know about. They were trying out a spray from a suitcase. So somebody carried a suitcase through Dulles Airport spraying this out. That is how one got launched. Another one got launched from an aerosol from somebody flying over San Francisco. The foot and mouth here was almost certainly an aeroplane. One of the flus that went into Salisbury in Rhodesia. In fact, the American ambassador to South Africa had overflown Salisbury a few days before. You get people to do things for different reasons. Very, very few of them know precisely why they're doing what they are doing. Most people in the peace organization think they're working for peace. The Friends of the Earth say they've 20,000 members. I doubt if more than 8 of them know what the reason for why they do what they are doing. But even they don't know the full pattern. Because the way, as I say, the way that octopus technique works, you could just give one group one objective, another group another objective. There's only a few people at the centre who've got the whole pattern.
I wonder what cover name might research on the flu virus and any other virus be done in this country. Well, what might the organisation be called or be doing?
Well, for instance, there's several university labs, and this is pure research. They're trying different methods of mutation. What's going on in MRE now the Department of Health's taken it over, I don't know. But probably most of the people working on it think they're working on something highly academic. You know, finding out how DNA works or something. Very few people need know what it is they're working on. And as I say, what they've avoided like the plague all the time is having a specific organisation that you can pin down. You see, Philby was a friend of Victor Rothschild, so was Burgess. McLean has probably got in through being blackmailed. Blunt was in it too, and they were part of a homosexual ring. So Burgess was given Rothschild's flat and all the homosexuals who went. Then if you read that book, The Last Temptation, Guy Liddell, his ex-girlfriend, was a leading communist, but she had married a man who became the Lord Mayor of London, and he didn't realise she kept her connections. He used to go and visit her and take all his MI5 problems when he was acting head of MI5 and discuss them with this woman.
You mentioned Iris Murdoch as being part of the original grouping.
Yes.
Do you think she's still working on the same net, or do you think she's outgrown?
Oh no, I think she's still working. Her job, you see, is to write novels to bring in an attitude of mind.
Do you see yourself, perhaps you have already, Kitty, I don't know, have you written your own book generally on the subject? You've written an awful amount here, there must be several
papers,
books.
I've only ever written one book, and that was a straight bone pathology textbook. That's it. And so, in fact, the next two books I've got on the three books that I've sort of said I will, two of them are straight textbooks.
You mentioned a friend of yours whose name I didn't recognise, who is writing a book called The Bitter Pill. Do you know who is publishing that?
Hutchinson.
And is she using a lot of material that you have given her, information and ideas?
She's used a lot of information I've given her, but she's used a great deal else because there have been a lot of doctors around the country worried about the pill. And it's become obvious that a lot of people working on it have lost their jobs. So she's taken information from a great many sources, as well as her own work.
And that actually has a publication date?
End of April.
Well, we're fascinated by all these things. And you've given us so much to think about, it's difficult to know where to start.
And you see, all this multiracial business, well, Jane Birdwood is really, Lady Birdwood, she's the one who's written the most on this.